Continue our journey through Holy Week with Jesus as he fights for peace each and every day. Who knows what day we're up to? It's on the screen. It's not a trick question. We're up to Wednesday. It's all right. First service had the same problem. That's okay. I guess they were looking at me instead of the screen. Who knows? We're up to Wednesday, so we've been through Sunday, Monday and Tuesday, obviously. In fact, Porterfield says in his book, Wednesday marks the midpoint of the Holy Week. It feels like the eye of a hurricane. Jesus has just weathered three tumultuous days. Sunday's crowds as he rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. Monday's cleansing as he tipped over tables and drove people and animals out of the temple. Tuesday's controversies as he poured out lamented woes over the Jewish leaders. And soon he will face the headwinds of betrayal, desertion and crucifixion. But on this particular day, all is quiet. Almost too quiet, he says. Jesus is lounging at the dinner table with some new friends. But we know that in the temple, the Jewish leaders are plotting, trying to find some sneaky way that they can arrest Jesus and kill him. So things are not as they seem, and the peace is not going to last, as we know. So this reading offers us three acts. The first act is the Jewish leaders. The second act is the woman. And the third act is the disciple. We'll work our way through and see what these acts teach us. And as we do, I encourage you to ask yourself, which character am I most like in each of these acts? Which character do I resonate with the most? And what choices am I making that are similar to some of these characters, perhaps? Act 1, the Jewish leaders. Mark tells us that the Passover festival was only a couple of days away. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were scheming to arrest Jesus secretly and kill him, but not during the festival, they said, or the people may riot. Some have interpreted that as being that they were actually scared of the people themselves, but further investigation would tend to suggest that's not actually what they were afraid of. They had a choice. They had a choice to either move towards Jesus or to move away from Jesus. The Jewish leaders could have actually, even at this point, swallowed their pride, changed their minds, and decided to accept Jesus' teaching, allowed themselves to believe that he was the promised Messiah that they knew so much about. So they had an option to do that, even at this stage. They could have come to Jesus' side, they could have accepted his teaching, and things would have turned out very, very differently. Or they could choose to work against Jesus. And as we've heard, that was what they were actively doing, not just work against him, but indeed get rid of him, kill him, just remove the issue from the face of the earth. In John's Gospel, he tells us that it was actually a meeting of the Sanhedrin. And at that meeting, they said, what are we accomplishing? This man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. So they weren't so much afraid of the people rioting, but they were afraid of what the riot would spark. The Romans were allowing the Jews to have their temple in Jerusalem. They were allowing the Jews to practice their faith. They were allowing them to have their festivals. But as soon as there was any sign of any kind of uprising, the Romans would clamp down on it. The Romans even had a tower that looked into the temple court so they could see what was going on, which is why the Jewish leaders were getting a little bit nervous even on Monday when Jesus was tipping tables over. The Roman guards would have been watching that with quite a lot of interest. And if it had got any further, then they probably would have flooded in and taken control of the place. So the leaders were really nervous about the ruckus that Jesus was causing and the following that he was receiving. People were resonating with his teaching. People were turning towards him and they were following him, and he was gathering quite a following. So at this meeting, the leaders, the Sanhedrin, the 70 who were the leaders of the Jewish movement, were coming together saying, well, what are we achieving anyway? What's this guy doing? If we let him go, we'll lose both our temple and our nation. They were worried that if the following of Jesus grew any more, then the Romans would step in and that they would potentially shut the whole temple down or stop the Jewish leaders from practicing. And they were quite accustomed to what they were doing. Indeed, one of them was called Caiaphas. We hear about Caiaphas all the time. He was the high priest that year, and he spoke up to them and said, you know nothing at all. You do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. Now, Caiaphas is actually quite a wise man. He was quite a smooth operator. Over that period from CE or AD, whichever terminology you like to use. But the first 66 years of the first century, from about 6 to 66, there were 18 different high priests that were elected into that role in the temple, but by the Romans. The Romans had a massive input into who became high priest, because the Romans needed somebody who had authority within the Jewish movement but would jump to their commands. They needed a puppet inside the Jewish movement, and the high priest was that puppet. So you can see that over 60 years there were 18 high priests, so on average they were only in power or in that position for 2 or 3 years. But Caiaphas held that position for 18 of those years, because Caiaphas worked out very quickly what the Romans wanted and how he could get that from the Jews. So he was the middleman, and he did very, very well out of it, financially as well as the authority and the power that he was given by the Romans. So he worked out what it took to be able to keep the peace that the Romans wanted to keep. The Romans had this thing called Pax Romana, which was the peace of Rome. It was the peace that the Roman soldiers were able to achieve through killing people. They would wander into a region, a country, a city or whatever. They would dominate by pure force. They had the most undefeatable fighting machine in the time. So they would roll into wherever, dominate, kill the people, kill the leaders that they needed to, make subjects of the rest, and then they would maintain peace through force. So anybody who stepped out of line, got a hiding or got killed, and then it was peaceful again. Everybody lived in fear of what the Romans would do to them, so they just kept a lid on what they were doing. Caiaphas worked out that he needed to make sure it looked like the Jews weren't causing any trouble. So whenever there was any kind of uprising, he would deal with it from inside the Jewish ranks. And therefore the Romans would be happy with him. He kept his job and all the trappings that went with it, and the whole place stayed peaceful, just because everybody was scared witless about what might happen otherwise. So Caiaphas makes this famous statement that's been used inside and outside the Bible all over the place. He says it's better for one man to die than for the whole nation to perish. He didn't actually say, mind you, that it was a good option. He didn't say that it was a good thing to kill Jesus. But he said, we've got two options. Neither of them are great, but killing one guy is better than all of us going down the tube. So let's get rid of Jesus. There were probably other options, I'd suggest, but he chose not to make those available. So that's where we get this saying of the lesser of two evils. So that's what they did. They went down that path. I wonder then, how often have we fallen into that same trap? How often have we chosen the lesser of two evils and not explored if there's a third option that actually is a more peaceful option? How often have we allowed ourselves to take the easy options and just choose the lesser of two evils? I wonder how also we might have said the ends justify the means. When have we perhaps allowed ourselves to engage in ungodly activities because we believe we're trying to achieve a godly outcome? That doesn't really cut it, does it? But it's something that naturally comes to us. We think we're doing something for God, so we do something ungodly in the meantime to try to achieve that end, whether that's how we treat people, how we treat ourselves, how we treat our environment, whatever it might be. Some things to think about. Act 2, the woman. Mark tells us that while Jesus was in Bethany at a lovely dinner party, a woman came in with an alabaster jar, very expensive perfume, as I explained to the children, broke the jar and poured the whole lot of perfume over Jesus' head. You'd probably get done for assault if you did that these days, wouldn't you? But Jesus knew what she was doing. Now, other gospel accounts suggest that Mary and Martha were actually running this dinner party in honour of Jesus, because Jesus had just raised Lazarus from the dead. But Mark and Matthew don't give her a name at all. They suggest that she's completely uninvited and that she's just walked in off the street. And I think they do that to heighten the social difference, I guess, the social standing. This woman doesn't even get the honour of having her name mentioned in this story. She's nameless, she has no identity, she has no authority, she has no power, but she takes the risk of coming in and pouring this perfume on Jesus' head. Some of those that were there complained about it indignantly, why this waste could have been sold for more than a year's wages, the money given to the poor, and they rebuked her harshly. The Greek word there is ebrimaomai, which means they snorted in anger like a horse. I've heard a horse snort in anger. It's pretty scary. So these guys were really upset at her pouring this perfume on Jesus. Now, were they actually upset about the waste, Or were they just upset about her interrupting their dinner party? Or were they upset about the audacity of this woman who's just wandered in unannounced? We'll get back to that in a second. But Jesus stands up for her. Leave her alone, he says. Why are you bothering her? She's done a beautiful thing to me. She's done a beautiful work, he says. The poor you will always have with you. You can help them any time, but you won't always have me. So he gives her credibility. He pours out his compassion on her immediately, and he basically rebukes these guys who are telling her off. He continues, she did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached, what she's done will be told in memory of her. No truer prophecy has ever been spoken, has it? Every single time this gospel passage gets read or preached on or analyzed or studied, this woman's actions brought to the fore again. This woman who in these gospels doesn't even have a name is honored for what she did for Jesus. And as explained to the children, she was actually honoring him as her king. In this passage, there are numerous people who are making choices. They've all got a choice, whether they take a godly choice and draw themselves closer to Jesus, or whether they make an ungodly choice and draw themselves further away from Jesus. Firstly, we have the woman who takes her life in her own hands, even walking into this dinner party, because we know that women were just completely downtrodden in this society. They weren't allowed to own land. They weren't allowed to have any assets. It's surprising that she even had this jar of alabaster perfume in her house at all. But it was probably a family heirloom that had been handed down from generation to generation as a social security, you might say. Sometimes families handed this asset down so that if one particular generation fell into hard times, they could sell it and use that money to get themselves back on their feet. We don't exactly know how or why she had this perfume. But she decided that she would wander into this gathering of predominantly men and take this action. Now, arguably, she could have even been stoned for this action because she just wasn't welcome there. So she takes her life into her own hands, comes in and anoints Jesus as the king of her life. As I said to the children, there's some commentary that suggests that he had already forgiven her sins, and she was incredibly grateful for that, and this was her response, to give him everything she had and risk her own life to actually go in and pour out this perfume for him and anoint him. The people who complained, John tells us that Judas was one of them, but he didn't complain because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As a keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. So the guys who were complaining may well not have been too worried about whether the money could go to the poor or not, but that it could go to themselves. We know that Judas was already on the trail of betrayal for Jesus. So he was already looking for an exit strategy out of the 12 disciples, and he needed some cash to be able to do that. If, for instance, she'd donated this perfume to him instead, he could have cashed it in and done quite well out of it, thank you very much, and jumped out and started his new life elsewhere. But we'll come back to that as well. There was also then, of course, the rest of the men who were there who were complaining about it. What was their actual motivation? There was probably numerous, whether they were actually just complaining about her being there, or the waste, or the mess that she'd made, numerous things that could have got on their goat. But then there's Jesus. Jesus had a choice to make as well. He could have sided with the boys, couldn't he? And rebuked her as well and said, look at the mess you made of me. But he didn't. He had compassion on her. He put himself in her shoes and he allowed himself to empathize with her. And instead of rebuking her, he rebuked the other fellas and said, no, she's done a good thing here. She's given everything she has and she's poured it out on me, anointing me as a king, but anointing me in preparation for my burial. And this is the first time in public that he had prophesied his own death. He told the disciples three times already. They still didn't get it. But it seems like this woman had recognized him as the Messiah. She was pouring out everything, and he responded by encouraging her, pouring out his compassion and siding with her, lifting her up, giving her some sort of honor, giving her some sort of identity. So I wonder how often have we perhaps made assumptions or judgments from our privileged position. No matter how rich or poor we might feel we are in our current circumstances, we're still more wealthy than most people in the world. The color of our skin gives us privilege. The place where we live gives us privilege. And from that privileged position, it's often hard for us to really identify with those who are less fortunate than ourselves. The class difference in Jesus' day was probably even more pronounced than it is now. Interestingly, we're told that he was in the house called of Simon the leper. This guy had had leprosy. Other commentators suggest that Jesus had already healed Simon of leprosy. But as a leper, he had no standing in society either. So he was still down in the lower echelons of society, and yet they still had the gut to rebuke this woman because she was even lower than them. That was their only way of building themselves up, was to push her down. I wonder how often we do that, either deliberately or inadvertently sometimes. How more times could we perhaps put ourselves in someone else's position and actually try to identify with them and see why they're doing what they're doing, or why they're in the position they're in, and help them out of that in a similar way. I wonder how often we haven't considered where the other people come from. Sometimes I've heard some really horrible comments about people who are homeless, drug addicts, alcohol addicts. People say, oh, it's their own fault. You know, I wonder what they did to deserve that. Or I wonder how come they're homeless. They must have squandered, you know, whatever finances they've had. Sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes the most responsible people end up finding themselves homeless through no fault of their own. So we need to be able to put ourselves in the position of other people. Ask questions. Don't make assumptions. Let's find out who they are, where they come from, why they are where they are, and what they need to get out of where they are. And how often do we expect someone else to do our dirty work? Jesus got his feet and his hands dirty, didn't he? He jumped in boots and all. He spent his time with the underprivileged. He spent his time with those who were kicked out of society. He allowed himself to touch lepers, to touch the ill, to touch the dead. That was a big no-no in Jewish society because that made you ritually unclean and you couldn't go to the worship, to the temple after that. Jesus put all that aside. He was a faithful Jew, but he put all that aside to be able to put himself in the shoes of somebody else, get down in the trenches and help them up and lift other people up instead of just expecting somebody else to do it. Something for us to think about. Act 3, the disciple. Good old Judas. Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priest to betray Jesus. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand Jesus over. They'd just been scheming how they could possibly get rid of Jesus, and all of a sudden Judas walks in. He was an answer to their prayer, you might say. They might have even suggested that they were on the right track because they thought God had brought Judas to them. Well, in a way, obviously God had. That was all part of God's plan. When Jesus chose Judas to be one of the 12, Jesus knew that Judas would be the one who would betray him. Jesus knew what Judas's characteristics was like. Jesus knew that Judas was a thief and yet still put him in charge of the money because it all had to work out this way in order that there be a betrayer who would hand Jesus over to the Jewish authorities. So that was all part of the plan, but nonetheless, it panned out the way that Jesus expected. So Judas had this choice as well. He could have stuck with Jesus and continued to walk with him and continue to support Jesus in his ministry. Or he had a choice where he could work against Jesus. He decides at this time that he's going to betray Jesus. But why? I wonder what his motivation was. Some people think it was just for greed. But Luke tells us that Satan entered Judas. That was definitely part of the equation. Judas was operating under the motivation of Satan. There's no doubt about that. But I think there's more to it. And Matthew tells us that when Judas approached the chief priest and said, "What are you willing to give me if I delivered Jesus over to you?" They counted out for him 30 pieces of silver. Some people think it was greed on Judas' part because he was so obsessed with money that he thought he could cash in, betray Jesus, build up his retirement fund, and live happily ever after. But 30 pieces of silver was worth nothing. This price that they offered him was worth nothing. It was in Exodus 21, it tells us that if your ox gores somebody else's slave and kills them, then you need to pay the owner of that slave 30 pieces of silver. That was the recompense for a dead slave. And clearly slaves are worth nothing anyway, but a dead slave was worth even less. But if my ox kills your slave, then I need to give you 30 pieces of silver because that's the going rate for a dead slave. So what the chief priests offer Judas for the life of Jesus is the same as that of a dead slave. The life of Jesus was worth nothing to them. And interestingly, Judas, despite being obsessed with money and was a great negotiator, accepted it. Judas was smart enough to know that these guys really wanted to get rid of Jesus. So he could have named his price and they would have paid it. He could have set up his retirement fund and lived happily ever after. But Jesus' life was worth nothing to Judas either. Now, how can that happen? This guy has been walking with Judas for years now. They have a close relationship, but now suddenly he's decided that it's all over and he's going to turn Jesus in. It's because, many commentators suggest, it's because Judas himself is feeling betrayed. He betrayed Jesus because he was feeling betrayed. Judas was a very passionate Jewish man, and Judas loved being on the winning team. So when Jesus came along, he thought, this is the guy. This is the Messiah. He's going to come in and smite the Romans for us. He's going to restore Israel back to its former glory. This is going to be awesome. Judas wanted to be one of the guys standing there waving the placards at the victory march, saying, here's our man, Jesus. He's brought Israel back to where it belongs, and we're no longer under the rule of these pesky Romans anymore. But just in these last few days, Judas has lost all of that. He's seen Jesus riding into Jerusalem on a donkey. It's supposed to be on like a war horse or something. He's supposed to be coming in to conquer the place. He rides in on a donkey. And then he cries, Jesus cries, over the fate of Jerusalem. Instead of taking up arms, he's weeping. Who is this wimp? Thinks Judas. The next day, Jesus goes into the temple where all of Judas's mates are making money out of the exchanges and selling the livestock. Jesus tips everything over, scatters the coins, chases the animals out, and upsets the whole business that's going on there. This was something that was quite possibly near and dear to Judas's heart. What's this Jesus doing? The next day, on Tuesday, Judas hears Jesus lamenting to the Pharisees. If only you knew what it would do to bring you peace. You're doing it all wrong. You're ignoring this, you're ignoring that. You're paying attention to these little things. You know, what did it say? You're straining out a gnat but swallowing a camel. Judas hears Jesus pouring out his heart to the Pharisees saying, come on, guys, you're on the wrong track. But Judas thought they were on the right track. So he's completely lost all faith in Jesus. He decides this guy isn't going to smite the Romans for us. Now he's talking about he's going to die. What's going on there? He's supposed to be killing everybody else, not dying himself. So Judas is feeling betrayed. His heart has completely changed towards Judas and towards Jesus. And he says, all right, that's it. I've got to do something about it. I can't let this Jesus go on any longer. He's not taking us down the right path. So he goes to the leaders and says, all right, he's yours for a pittance. So he hands him over. The Jewish leaders paid coins of silver for Jesus' life, and yet Jesus still paid his life for the Jewish leaders. There's not much economy in that, is there? I wonder how often have we rejected those who have not met our expectations. One of the underlying issues here was that Judas had all these expectations, and for a start, Jesus was meeting them. But then all of a sudden, he lost the plot in Judas' eyes. And so Judas' expectations were no longer met, and he decided he needed to do something about it. I've been around for a few years, I've been in business for a few years, and I've learned that one of the most important things in successful business or successful relationships is just managing expectations. Communicating with people, understanding what they expect of me, negotiating if their expectations are unreasonable, and then trying to meet the expectations that are reasonable. But if you don't communicate, or if you just choose not to meet the expectations, then there's going to be a fight, or there's going to be a death of a relationship along the line. So I wonder how often we reject those who have not met our expectations. I wonder how we've not considered the expectations of others. As we've been dealing with them, we haven't asked them what they actually expect. We've just made assumptions or just delivered what we thought was a fair expectation on our part. I wonder also how often we've actually cut people off when they haven't agreed with us. I've seen so many times just recently that if someone disagrees with you, then you assume that they are against you, that they don't like you, that they hate you. So you cut them off and cut off that relationship completely. Instead of persevering, instead of negotiating a way through, instead of finding out why they did what they did, that can be such a key thing because we don't know what's going on in their life. We don't know what sort of triggers are happening. We don't know what sort of pain or history or sensitivities there are in their life. And so sometimes we might, if they say something that hurts us, maybe we need to ask them, well, let's work through that a bit and put my pain aside just for a little while and learn why you did that. And then maybe you get the opportunity to explain the pain you're feeling, but more importantly, you reach out to them and try to understand the pain that they're feeling. So you can bring them peace and bring peace back into the relationship. As followers of Christ, we are called to choose to live in peace. It's not easy. Was it Malcolm Fraser said that or something? I don't know, one of the politicians. It wasn't meant to be easy. It's hard. You've got to work for it. But we've got to work for it in peaceful ways. We've got to choose to work for peace and not just let the status quo drift on and let things drift off into some kind of just, you know, disservice or whatever. We need to take responsibility and take action to maintain peace, to keep peace. And where peace has been broken, we're called to restore peace using means that are consistent with the end goal. Not do the Roman thing and say, we need to fix this relationship, so I'm going to beat you until you comply. That's not really going to work. We need to use peaceful means to achieve a peaceful outcome. That means it's going to take longer. That means it's going to take a lot more work. That means it's going to take a lot more of our love and our understanding and our resilience to get that to happen. But it means that we do achieve a peaceful outcome using peaceful means the way that Jesus has taught us. And we need to get out into the margins of society and from there recognize the destructive nature of violence and contend for peace from there. We need to put ourselves in other people's shoes and work for peace from that point instead of trying to push peace on them from our point of view. We need to work from where they are and lift them up and bring them back into a peaceful relationship with each other, with God, so that the world can be a place of peace. It's possible, I believe. Jesus tells me it is, so I believe him. Lots of things there for us to think about. So as you do that, I wonder what your choice is. Every day we're making these choices, aren't we? Are we going to move closer to Jesus, or are we going to make a choice that actually takes us further away? But we're always called to choose peace and choose to work towards peace. So as you endeavour to do that, I pray that the peace of God, which is beyond our human understanding, will keep your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Amen.